Welcome to another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. Today going to feature a book that All Books published back in 2010 by Julie Gilgoff, G-I-L-G-O-F-F. It's called A Granddaughter's Rite of Passage, Tales from the McCarthy Era. Reason being that I didn't think this stuff would have a resurgence, but it's like the McCarthy era on steroids, gone global. For those too young not to know, or to have not seen films and read about, as I have done, since it was a bit before my time, the McCarthy era was a also known as the Red Scare, anti-communist. Many people were blacklisted, many people lost jobs, families were affected. So it sadly parallels what's going on today with various sports players, opera singers, concerts, literature, anything Russian is being questioned whether to be allowed.
And I'm going to preface reading from this book to show you the context is no joke. The Jimmy Dore show, I'll read the synopsis of one episode. It's titled The View. That's the TV talk show with Whoopi Goldberg and Joy Behar and other women. The View calls for arrest of Tulsi and Tucker Carlson over Ukraine. In an unprecedentedly dim-witted conversation, the hosts of The View all expressed agreement that prominent individuals expressing skepticism about all-out war on Russia like Tucker Carlson and Tulsi Gabbard are traitors who need to be investigated and possibly even arrested for their thought crimes. The hosts all outdo one another in trotting out McCarthyite smears and denunciations of Russian propaganda while spreading their own form of NATO propaganda and misinformation. And if people would look at the information and the facts, they would find out that UK and other countries are shipping weapons. There's going to be... The US comes out and says they're not sending weapons, but weapons are being shipped to Ukraine. So there's going to be like extremists and not neo-Nazis are getting shipped weapons. And so people that speak out against that are then called out as traitors and treasonous. So the hypocrisy is just ludicrous. But that's why I bring up this book as a context that perhaps to show the personal flavors and what can be learned.
So I wanted to read a little bit of this book flavor of how the U.S. has been anti-Russia for, it seems like, at least, I'm not a historian, it's at least 70 years now. A couple of blurbs on the back give the summary. 50 years after the end of the McCarthy era, the story of its impact on blacklisted families has scarcely been told. Julie Gilgoff's poignant, well-researched memoir is both a tribute to her extraordinary grandfather, teacher, poet, and community activist Max Gilgoff, and a rare insider's view of that, quote, scoundrel time, end quote. Threatened with dismissal by the New York City Board of Education, Gilgoff died in 1952, leaving behind a pregnant wife and two young sons. The story of Julie Gilgoff's nationwide search for her grandfather's colleagues, friends, and other children of the blacklist is as compelling a personal tale as it is a valuable historic record. And another blurb, Julie Gilgoff sets off on a personal journey to discover the contours of her grandfather's life during the McCarthy period, and in the process uncovers a network of committed activists whose children and grandchildren still bear the marks of those persecuted. This book shows us how the past is inescapable and how it shapes our present actions. The epigraph is from Edward R. Murrow, who one of the last real journalists. There's a good movie I saw a long time ago, Good Night and Good Luck, which kind of depicts the end of the honest TV journalism era. And there's a quote of his that I just found from 1958 when a speech given by Murrow to the Radio and Television News Directors Association in a salute to Edward R. Murrow, in which he harshly admonishes his audience not to squander the potential of television to inform and educate the public so that it does not become, quote, So it does not become only, quote, wires and lights in a box, end quote. Well, now it's one of the biggest propaganda machines ever. So anyway, here's the Edward R. Murrow quote. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason. If we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men. A few sample pages. Chapter is the Rosenbaums. 3 years after Max and Terry's first interrogation in 1951, Terry received another letter to report to a courthouse in Midtown Manhattan. He was not allowed to bring any family members, only a lawyer. Seated in the courthouse was Senator Joseph McCarthy himself. Terry said that when McCarthy asked him, "Are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?" he took the Fifth Amendment. Refusing to give evidence that could be self-incriminating is a right that the Fifth Amendment is supposed to ensure for all American citizens. But this right did not offer protection in the McCarthy era. Ferdinand Pecora, a New York Supreme Court justice, ruled in 1950 that, quote, the New York Board of Education could dismiss teachers if they refused to answer questions posed by congressional committees, end quote. This is happening today if people refuse to denounce Putin. And the book continues, the Los Angeles Board of Education followed the same rule as its New York counterpart, which was automatic dismissal for any teacher invoking the Fifth Amendment. The Hollywood Ten had been blacklisted by the House Committee on Un-American Activities for citing the First Amendment right to freedom of speech and of peaceful assembly. Terry tried a different approach. Terry was a history teacher who believed in the U.S. Bill of Rights, even when it was not being upheld by the government. For refusing to say he was a communist, Terry was fired shortly after his meeting with Joseph McCarthy. Like my grandfather Max, he never belonged to the Communist Party.
That's another excellent movie, one of the Hollywood Ten.
And here's a chapter, Robert Mirepoix's Constructive Revenge. Robert Mirepoix, son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, faced the opposite problem that I had. Whereas I was trying to piece together my family history from scratch, everyone knew about his parents. More than 50 years after the Rosenbergs' execution, an active debate still surrounded Robert's parents' purported espionage in the Cold War. When Robert was 6 years old, his parents were executed for allegedly leaking atomic secrets to the Soviets. In years to come, on television and in the newspapers, Robert saw graphic images of his parents killed in the electric chair. He then had to read accounts of his family history, some of which he found offensive or untrue. I visited Robert one day in Massachusetts at his organization, the Rosenberg Fund for Children. And that goes on there. Another section, chapter, Cultural Judaism. Max, that's Julie's grandfather, Max spoke Yiddish fluently, as did his parents in the 1930s. The American Communist Party had an entire Yiddish-speaking section of Jewish communists. Just like Max, many other Jewish activists of the 50s had parents who emigrated from Eastern Europe, where they had been persecuted for being Jewish. They came to the United States thankful to be able to practice Judaism freely. Max's mother kept a kosher kitchen, separating milk and meat dishes, and was proud that her son was growing fatter as a result of her Jewish cooking. In the United States, they had enough to eat. Terry Rosenbaum and his wife Beth were both atheists who raised their two daughters without organized religion. But at 10 years old, Terry and Beth's daughter, Lisa Rosenbaum, began to sneak out of the house with her friends in order to attend their neighborhood synagogue. And here's another section, I think one more section here, about the challenges of the times. This is about her father. When my dad finally retired from Newsday due to illness, the associate editor Rich Gallant praised Henry for blazing the trail as a true pioneer of consumer reporting in the newspaper business. Gallant said, before there was Help Me Howard and all the other consumer affairs reporters, there was Henry, working diligently to bring his readers the real story. He called my dad the soul of the business desk, who questioned not only the companies that were mistreating consumers, but the internal structure of Newsday itself. My father continuously probed what lay behind the surface, not unlike his father. This didn't always make him popular with his employer. My mother says that one time someone from Newsday's advertising department called Henry to, quote, encourage, end quote, him to stop reporting on a car dealership's illegal scams. It was unusual to receive a call like this, since the wall between the business department and general newsroom was barely breached. But this company advertised regularly in the paper, providing a significant source of revenue. They felt entitled to ask that the negative press be discontinued. My father was outraged that such an issue would even be brought to a reporter's attention, since doing so compromised the moral integrity of the paper and the whole notion of ethical journalism. He refused to change one iota of his honest reporting. And one chapter, I like the title, it's a quote her father used to say, I got my borscht, I got my daughter. We'll try ordering borscht in a restaurant today and see what happens. And another bit, chapter talking across generations. As my research continued, I came across a documentary by Ivy Mirapol. She is the granddaughter of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, the couple executed in the electric chair for purportedly leaking atomic secrets to the Soviet Union. Ivy's documentary, Heir to an Execution, looks into her grandparents' past. Ivy grew up with the images of her grandparents around the house, but she was hesitant to ask her father questions. Instead, she confronted these issues as an adult and interviewed her father, Michael Mirapol, and her grandparents as friends. I knew that people were out there who could answer my questions, she said. I just needed to get to them before they were gone, end quote. After seeing Ivy's documentary, I decided to interview her uncle, Robert Mirapol. As the son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, he surprised me by saying that his childhood was a happy one, and he felt loved by his parents. How did he come away from his childhood with love, even though his parents went away to prison when he was 3 and were later executed when he was 6? Robert admitted that he needed to find an outlet for what he called constructive revenge, so as to deal with his anger. The positive outlet came through the organization he founded, the Rosenberg Fund for Children, which provides emotional and financial aid to children of political activists.
So here we are in the thick of some deep propaganda BS, so let's do what we can to learn from the history so we can not repeat. So thank you for listening. Have a good one and be well.